At 16, he got a job as a dishwasher at an ice cream parlor and began saving his money. He bought a used car and learned how to repair it. He bought new clothes and began dating. He soon became serious with a girl named Julie and began spending all his free time with her. My mom didn't think it was a good idea to be so serious about a girl at such a young age, and they argued about that as well. Once she caught the two of them napping in his room and all hell broke loose. I don't think I'd ever seen my mom angrier about anything. It was around that time that my mom marched into my dad's office. My dad had been all but irrelevant when it came to raising us, but my mom could go no further without his help. "I raised them this far," she said. "Now it's your turn." My dad simply nodded. It was, he probably thought, a lot better than cooking or cleaning. After that, I remember evenings where I'd find Micah sitting in the office, visiting with my dad. My dad was exceptionally smart, and he read almost constantly. He taught behavioral theory and management at California State University in Sacramento, and read every conceivable book that had been written on the subjects. Seriously, there were thousands of books in his office at any given time, stacked along shelves, piled on the floor, stored in boxes, and he'd read every one. In the evenings, I could always find him sitting at his desk with his feet propped up reading. He read amazingly fast. On average, he would finish one or two books in an evening, jotting notes as he went along. His hours were unlike anyone else's in the family. Because he taught in the afternoons, he usually stayed awake until 5 a.m. and then slept until noon. Though my dad always kept his office door open, we all knew that he was most comfortable alone. He was a quiet, attentive listener. When talking to his co-workers, I was always struck by how much they seemed to adore him. My dad could listen to a person ramble on without ever feeling the need to interrupt. Nor, unless asked, would he ever offer advice. Instead, he would clarify your problem, rewording what you'd said in a way that crystallized your thoughts and allowed you to solve the problem on your own. When talking to Micah, and later when talking to me, his routine was always the same. He would ask what was going on regarding a specific situation, then would listen while you filled in the void. And the more Micah or I talked, the less he would say. Sometimes these one-sided conversations lasted upward of an hour. We would usually leave his office thinking more clearly and believing he was one of the smartest people we'd ever met. In the end, my dad gave us three ironclad rules that we were bound to throughout our teenage years. They were: A, don't drink and drive; B, don't get a girl pregnant; C, be in by your curfew, midnight as a freshman, and increasing half an hour with every passing year in high school. My dad, by the way, was very shrewd to offer us these particular rules when he did. We would soon be reaching the age where one or another might become an issue, but since we were following all three already, they seemed entirely reasonable at the time. Even more important, by our teenage years, we'd been on our own so long that anything more would have seemed draconian, too little, too late, and no doubt would have led to outright rebellion. These, however, seemed well thought out, and Micah agreed to abide by them. Micah, it must be said, followed those rules, and only those rules. Everything else, it seemed, was up for grabs. And for the next couple of years, he continued to press the outer limits. On more nights than I can count, I remember listening to my mom and dad fretting about him. "He just keeps getting wilder," one would say. "What do we do?" A long silence would follow. "I don't know," the other one would answer. That year brought about changes for me, too. I began competing in track and field, and though not great, I was one of the better freshmen on the team. This isn't saying much, since in the distance events there were only a handful of us. Still, I loved track and field. And as fate would have it, there was a genuine track and field legend who also lived in Fair Oaks. Billy Mills, an Oglala Sioux Indian raised in poverty in the Black Hills of South Dakota, had won the Olympic gold medal in the 10,000-meter run at the Tokyo Games in 1964. It is still regarded as the greatest upset in Olympic track and field history. He's the only American ever to win the Olympic 10,000 meters, and proving his talent for posterity, broke the world record the following year. Years earlier, I'd read about him in one of the many almanacs I'd perused as a kid, and I'd been fascinated by his story. When I learned that he lived in Fair Oaks, I was ecstatic, and I remember running to the kitchen to tell my mother. "Oh, Billy," she said, nodding. "I know him and his wife, Pat." My eyes widened.
"You do?"
"Yeah," she said easily. "They get their glasses at our office. They're wonderful people." All I could do was stare at her, thinking that I was standing next to someone who'd actually talked to a genuine American hero. This was heady stuff for a kid, and after talking to my mom, I was always on the lookout for him. I'd get excited when I saw him walking into the grocery store. I'd memorized how he looked, or into a restaurant, but I couldn't summon the courage to introduce myself. When I learned that informal neighborhood track meets were held at the local high school, I wanted to go because I suspected that he might be there as well. Sure enough, he was there, and when I saw him, I was transfixed. I'd watch him walk and think to myself, "That's how the fastest man in the world moves," and try to imitate it. Needless to say, I wanted to impress him with my talent, but to be honest, it never happened. Billy had three daughters, and his youngest competed. Unlike me, however, she was great, and never once lost a single race. Learning about Billy's past led me to read about other great runners. I dreamed of running like Henry Rono, Sebastian Coe, or Steve Ovett. But that's all it was, a dream. Yet I went out for the track team, and gradually I became friends with Harold Kufalt, a junior who was also on the team. Like Billy, Harold was almost a legend, albeit a high school one. Harold was one of the fastest runners in the country. He would record the nation's fastest time in the 2 mile for juniors and hold the American junior record for a while. And as with Billy, I idolized him from afar. Again, there's a world of difference between the lives of freshmen and upperclassmen. Yet one afternoon, toward the end of the season, the team was running as a group and I found myself running alongside Harold. We started chatting until Harold eventually grew quiet. "I've been watching you run," Harold said to me after a few moments of companionable silence. "You can be great if you work at it. Not just good, but great. You're a natural at this." I remember nothing about the run after that. It seemed as if I were floating, carried along by the words he'd said. There was nothing anyone could have said that would have meant more to me than what he'd told me. Not only did his words feed my fantasies, but they also touched the deeper core within myself, the one that always sought approval from my parents. "I could be great," he'd said. "I'm a natural." I vowed at that moment to make his words prophetic, and instead of spending the summer goofing around as I usually did, I decided to train instead. I trained hard, harder than I'd trained during the season. And the harder I worked, the harder I wanted to work. I ran twice a day, often in temperatures exceeding 100 degrees, and frequently ran until I vomited from exertion. Despite Harold's words, I wasn't a natural athlete, but what I lacked in talent I made up for with desire and effort. My brother, meanwhile, was working and earning money. In the past couple of years, he'd matured a bit and was rapidly becoming a man, and a handsome man at that. Combined with his natural confidence and charm, he quickly became irresistible to the opposite sex. The fact that he had a steady girlfriend didn't seem to matter. Girls flocked to his side or admired him from afar. My brother was essentially a babe magnet. Not so for me. I was shorter than Micah, with skinny arms and legs, and had none of the easy confidence of my brother. It didn't matter, however. Running offered me the chance to excel if I worked hard enough. And I began focusing on it to the exclusion of everything else that summer. Well, almost everything. I was as worried about Micah as my parents were. Toward the end of the summer, after much lobbying, I convinced him to join the cross-country team with me. The team, led by Harold, was expected to be one of the best in the state and would travel to meets in both the Bay Area and Los Angeles, where after the meets we would have the chance to visit amusement parks or boardwalks, places we would ordinarily never have the money or excuse to visit. "All you have to do is run fast enough to be in the top 7, I told him, "and you'll have more fun than you could ever imagine." He finally took me up on it. Once my brother started running, he quickly made the top 7. Our team went undefeated, and for the most part, Harold did as well. Harold broke course records at nearly every meet, and ended up finishing 2nd in the high school national championships. While Micah didn't focus on running the way I did, with a desperate determination to excel in it, it nonetheless changed him for the better. He was part of a team that counted on him. And, not surprisingly, considering the way he'd been raised, he took the responsibility seriously. Little by little, he began courting less trouble, and the more successful the team became, the more he took pride in being part of it. It didn't seem to matter to him that I was faster than he was. In fact, he was always the first to congratulate me on how I'd done. More important to me, however, was that we were spending time together again for the first time in years, and best of all, enjoying it. My sophomore year was transformative. Not only did I learn to love athletics and running, but it was the first time in my life that I outperformed my brother physically. At the same time, I continued to focus on getting good grades. Unfortunately, it was becoming more and more of an obsession. Not only did I want straight A's, but I wanted to be the top student in every class. I also began devouring novels. My mother, like my father, was an avid reader, and she frequented the library twice a month. There she would check out anywhere from 6 to 8 books and read them all. She particularly loved the works of James Herriot and Dick Francis. As for me, I discovered the classics. Don Quixote, The Return of the Native, Crime and Punishment, Ulysses, Emma, and Great Expectation, among others, and grew to love the works of Stephen King. Because I'd been raised on old horror movies, they struck a chord with me, and I'd read them over and over as I anxiously awaited a new title to be released. In my sophomore year, I also had my first real girlfriend. Her name was Lisa, and like me, she ran cross-country. She was a year younger than I, and as fate would have it, her father was Billy Mills, my boyhood hero. We dated for the next 4 years, and I not only fell in love with Lisa, but with her family as well. Billy and Pat were different from my parents in that they genuinely seemed to revel in my accomplishments. More than that, Billy would talk to me about my training and the goals I wanted to reach, and had a way of making me believe they were possible. My life was growing busier. Between school, running, homework, and Lisa, I didn't have much time for anything else. Nor did I have any money, and I came to realize that this situation wasn't exactly conducive to dating. Since our parents didn't give us allowances, nor would they open their wallets if we wanted to go to the movies, I decided to follow my brother's lead. After the cross-country season ended, and on top of everything else I was doing, I got a job as a dishwasher at the same restaurant where my brother worked. In the beginning, I worked until closing 2 school nights a week. Within a few months, I was working 35 hours a week and had been moved up to busboy. Eventually, I became a waiter and with tips was earning a tidy sum for a high school student. Every minute of every day was accounted for. I was on the go from 7 in the morning until nearly midnight 7 days a week, and the schedule would remain essentially unchanged until I graduated 2 years later. On our training runs, Micah and I often talked about both the past and the future. Sometimes we talked about our dreams, other times we talked about money. "Do you ever stop to think about how poor we were when we were younger?" he asked me. "Sometimes, but to be honest, I never really knew that we were poor until a couple of years ago." "I hated being poor," he said. "I've always hated it. I don't know what I'm going to do when I get older, but I'm not going to be poor. I want to be a millionaire by 35. I don't know how, but that's what I'm going to do." "You'll make it," I said. "How about you?" I smiled. "I want to be a millionaire by 30. Micah said nothing. Our strides moved in unison, our feet slapping the ground with almost perfect precision. "What?" I finally asked. "You don't think I'll make it?" "I don't know," he said. "I just think 35 is more realistic." "So what are you going to do to make it?" "Who knows? How about you?" "I have absolutely no idea." My brother and I ran together, worked together, and in our free time began to hang out with the same friends. Harold, Mike Lee, another member of the cross-country team, Tracy Yates, California State champion in wrestling, Micah and I called ourselves the Mission Gang. Despite our general reputation as model student athletes, we shared a sort of Jekyll and Hyde type existence. It was with them that I got drunk for the first time in my life, and we found tremendous joy in using fireworks in ways that weren't entirely smart or even legal. We regularly blew up various friends' mailboxes, whooping with delight when they were launched into the air with big kabooms. We also TP'd friends' houses with so much toilet paper that it looked like it had snowed the night before. Once, around Christmas, we came across a street where every house was decorated with twinkling lights. Over the next 2 hours, thinking we were so funny, we unscrewed every light bulb and hauled them off. We'd filled 6 plastic garbage bags with lights, and the houses looked as if they'd been visited by the Grinch. I really and truly can't explain why we did such things. It's juvenile and embarrassing. But I can't help but think that if we had a chance to go back in time, we'd end up doing those things again. Due to the time we spent together, my brother and I grew close again. By then, however, our relationship had changed from what it once was. We weren't simply brothers anymore. We'd become good friends. From my sophomore year on, we never had another argument or fight about anything. In the spring, my brother and I competed in the same events, and my training had begun to pay off. With me leading off and Harold as the anchor, we set meet record after meet record, and our distance medley team ended up running the fastest time in the country. Harold won the state championship in the 2-mile, and my time in the 800 was tops among sophomores nationwide. Among my family, only Micah was there to cheer me on. My parents rarely made it to meets. In fact, in my entire career, they would see me run and break records only once. While some might think my parents' lack of interest is odd, it never bothered me. After all, they didn't watch Micah run or see Dana participate on the drill team either. More important, we were doing these things for ourselves. We'd been on our own for so long by then that we didn't expect them to attend these events. And I think all three of us kids understood that our parents were so busy during the week, working, keeping up the house, tending to daily responsibilities, taking care of us, and struggling with finances, that it didn't seem fair to ask them to devote their weekends to us as well, when we all understood that other activities were more relaxing for them. My mom, for instance, loved to work in the yard or on the house, and nothing made her happier than planting bushes or trees or painting one of the rooms. Whenever I'd returned from a meet, she'd have a smudge of dirt or paint on her cheeks. Her jeans were spotted and stained like a laborer's. My dad, on the other hand, used the weekends to catch up on work in a quiet house and enjoyed organizing and reorganizing the books that lined his shelves. And no doubt it was nice to have a quiet house once in a while. Whether they took advantage of that to spend some quality time together, none of us ever knew. Our parents were very private when it came to their personal relationship and told us little about their days. And none of us ever bothered to ask. Micah trained with me the following summer, and as a senior, he'd become one of the better runners in the area. At most meets, we would both finish in the top three, but Micah never became as serious about running as I did. After graduating, he went to California State University at Sacramento and put his energies into enjoying life instead. He dated one beautiful girl after the next, skied on the weekends, took up snowboarding, and fell in love with mountain biking. He went boating and water skiing and spent weekends in San Francisco, Lake Tahoe, or Yosemite. He went white water rafting and eventually mastered it well enough to become a guide. He was a member of a yacht crew that raced on weekends. He moved into an apartment near campus and joined other students at bars and nightclubs. Every weekend it seemed he was doing something new, something exciting, reveling in his newfound freedom. At the same time, he kept up his grades and worked as an intern at a commercial real estate firm. I, on the other hand, spent my senior year as a nervous wreck. Good grades had become an obsession. I was on the verge of graduating valedictorian and didn't want this honor to slip from my grasp at the last moment. Furthermore, I knew that if I continued to run well, there was a chance I'd get a scholarship, a goal I'd set for myself. But I had yet to receive an offer and wouldn't until nearly April. I continued to work 35 hours a week and spent whatever free time I did have with my girlfriend. The stress of keeping it all going led to horrible bouts of insomnia. I slept less than 3 hours a night and felt constantly on edge. Part of me envied the kind of life that Micah was living. I admired his ability to simply live without having to achieve. In the hallways at school, I'd listen to friends describing their weekends at Folsom Lake or how much fun they'd had skiing at Squaw Valley. Maybe I should try to have more fun, a voice would whisper inside me. But every time I heard it, I forced myself to push the voice away. With a shake of my head, I'd tell myself that I didn't have time, that I couldn't risk injury, that I was too close to the finish line to quit now. But I wasn't necessarily happy. My goals had become ends in and of themselves, and there was little joy in pursuing them. Nonetheless, I somehow survived, and just as I wanted, I graduated valedictorian. A month earlier, after running one of the fastest 800-meter times in the country, I'd accepted a full athletic scholarship to the University of Notre Dame. And 3 months later, I would be living in South Bend, Indiana, 2,000 miles from the only family I'd ever known. Part of me didn't want to go off to college. If you lived the sort of childhood I did, you're forced to bond with your family. My brother and sister, along with my parents, had been the only constants in my life. And though I'd known for years that it was inevitable, it was still a little frightening for me to leave them behind. While I've written a lot about Micah and myself, I don't want to leave you with the impression that my sister was any less important to me. In the early years, my sister and I played together as much as Micah and I did, albeit in different ways. She was always the one I talked to about our adventures. She was the one I talked to when I was having trouble in my relationship with Lisa. In the end, I talked to my sister about everything I'd felt growing up. And my sister, more than anyone else, seemed to understand why I'd become the person I had. Even better, my sister loved me, and she alone seemed to have the ability to put things into perspective for me. My struggles had always been her struggles, and hers had always been mine. And if you ask my brother, he would say exactly the same things about her, for he had the same type of relationship with Dana that I did. Toward the end of my senior year, I remember hearing my sister crying in her bedroom. After knocking, I went in and found her sitting on the bed, her face in her hands. "What's wrong?" I asked, taking a seat beside her.
"Everything."
"No, tell me, what happened?"
"I hate my life," she said.
"Why?"
"Because," she said, "I'm not like you or Micah."
"I don't understand."
"You guys, both of you, you have everything. You're good at everything. You have good friends. You're good in sports. You get good grades. You're popular, and you both have girlfriends.
Everyone knows who you guys are, and they wish they could be more like you. I'm not like you two in any way. It's like I came from different parents."
"You've always been better," I said. "You're the sweetest person I've ever met."
"So what? No one cares about that." I took her hand. "What's really bothering you?" She didn't want to answer. In the silence, I looked around the room. Like most teenage girls, she had various magazine pictures lining the walls. On her dresser was a collection of bells and ceramic horses. A Bible sat on her end table next to a rosary, and above her bed was a crucifix. It took a long time for her to get the words out.
"Holly got asked to the junior prom."
Holly was my sister's best friend. They'd been inseparable for years.
"That's good, isn't it?"
When she didn't answer, my heart sank as I suddenly realized why she was so upset.
"But you're upset because no one asked you."
She began to cry again, and I slipped my arm around her.
"You'll get asked," I said soothingly. "You're a great girl. You're beautiful and kind, and anyone who doesn't ask you is too dumb to realize what they're missing."
"You don't understand," she said. "You and Micah, well, all the girls think you're both cute. They always tell me how lucky I am that you're my brothers. But it's hard. I mean, no one ever says that I'm pretty."
"You are pretty," I insisted.
"No," she said. "I'm not. I'm average. And when I look in the mirror, I know that."
She continued to cry and refused to say anything more. When I finally left the room, I realized for the first time that my sister struggled with the same insecurities everyone had. She had simply been hiding them all along. But as I walked away, I was certain that she'd get asked. I'd meant what I'd said to her. But as the days rolled on and no boy rode up on a horse to be her knight in shining armor, I could see the pain in her disappointed, wounded expression. It killed me to think that no one seemed to realize how special she was, how much love she could offer to anyone who simply asked. I adored my sister in the same way I'd always adored my brother, and, like my parents, I suppose, I felt the need to protect her. So one evening, about a week before the prom, I went into my sister's room. If her friends thought I was handsome, if they thought I was popular, then I wanted nothing more than for them to see how much fun we could have together. To me, it made no difference that we were brother and sister. I would be proud to be seen with her and wanted the entire world to know it. "Dana," I said seriously, "would you go to the prom with me?"
"Don't be silly," she said.
"We'll have fun," I promised. "I'll take you out to a fancy dinner, I'll rent the limousine, and we'll dance the night away. I'll be the best date you've ever had."
She smiled but shook her head.
"No, that's okay. I don't want to go anyway. I'm over it now. It doesn't matter."
I hesitated, trying to see if she meant it.
"Are you sure? It would mean a lot to me."
"Yeah, I'm sure. But thank you for asking." I looked at her. "You're breaking my heart, you know." She gave a sad little laugh.
"That's funny," she said.
"It's exactly the same thing Micah said."
"What do you mean?"
"He asked me to the prom, too. Yesterday."
"And you're not going with him either?"
"No." She wrapped her arms around me and gave me a hug. Then she kissed me on the cheek. "But I want you to know that you two are the best brothers that a sister could ever have. I get so proud when I think about you two. I'm the luckiest girl in the world, and I love you both so much." My throat constricted.
"Aw, Dana," I said.
"I love you, too."
Chapter 11, Ayers Rock, Australia, February 2nd to 3rd.
Unless you travel over the Pacific, it's hard to fathom how large the ocean actually is. We'd flown for 4 hours to reach Easter Island, and another 7 hours to Rarotonga. Reaching Brisbane, Australia took another 7 hours, during which we crossed over the international dateline, and from there we still had another 3 hours until we finally reached Ayers Rock, in the Uluru Kathajuda National Park, in the middle of the Australian outback. Passing the international dateline only served to make the journey longer. It's an odd feeling to realize that a day seems to have vanished from your life. Not only that, our stop in Brisbane took a couple of hours. All in all, it was over 12 hours en route, which struck me as amazing considering that we'd already been halfway across the ocean when we started. By the time we got to our hotel, everyone wore the look of weary travelers. In the lobby, it was possible to sign up for excursions the following day. While everyone would go to Ayers Rock in the afternoon, the morning was open. You could rent Harleys, for instance, and explore parts of the outback on your own, or take a helicopter ride over the Ulgas, an outcropping of rock and canyons near Ayers Rock. There was also a walking tour through part of the Ulgas as well, and a sunrise trip to Ayers Rock, which would leave the hotel before dawn. Though my brother and I wanted to sleep, we somehow woke in time to join the sunrise expedition party. It was cool and pitch black in the desert. Without lights, it was possible to see tens of thousands, if not millions, of stars. Our bus was one in a long line of buses that made their way out there that morning. We later found out that our hotel was large enough to room over 3,000 guests. While this may not mean much in a city like Orlando or Chicago, in the middle of the outback, it's amazing. At any given moment, we learned, the hotel itself had a higher population than nearly every city for hundreds of miles in any direction. Ayers Rock is the largest monolith, or single-unit stone, in the world. With a circumference of nearly 5 miles, it rises nearly 1,000 feet in the air and extends over 3 miles beneath the surface. In the pre-dawn blackness, Ayers Rock was nothing but a darkened shadow, almost impossible to see unless you were looking directly toward it. Our disheveled group stumbled out of the bus and we made our way to the viewing area. In time, light began glowing over the horizon, and as it slowly began to spread, our gaze was directed to the rock. Comprised of coarse-grained sandstone rich in feldspar, Ayers Rock was supposed to vary in color depending on the time of day and atmospheric conditions. Still, in the beginning anyway, it was difficult to understand why so many people found it fascinating. It had none of the fiery brilliance for which the rock had become famous. My brother and I took pictures, then more pictures, feeling disappointed. Soon, however, the sun rose high enough to brighten the eastern sky. And just when we came to the conclusion that the reputation of Ayers Rock was more hype than reality, it suddenly happened. The sun hit the rock at such an angle that it began glowing red like an enormous glowing coal. And for the next few minutes, all Micah and I could do was stare at it, thinking it was one of the most amazing things we'd ever seen. Micah and I had opted for the helicopter ride instead of a walking tour through the Ulgas, and by 8 a.m. we were at the airport again, ready to depart. There was, we learned, a good reason for taking the ride as early as we did. It was already hot by the time we arrived. It was summer in the desert, after all, and the canopy of the helicopter served only to intensify the heat. With 5 people crowded inside, everyone was sweating within moments of liftoff. We were in the air a little more than 30 minutes, but it afforded us views impossible to see any other way. We circled Ayers Rock and flew over the Ulgas. We spotted wild camels trailing through the desert. There were, we learned, tens of thousands of wild camels in Australia. They were non-indigenous. Originally, they'd been imported for their survival skills to help settle the outback. A few had escaped and flourished. Over time, the population had swelled. Nowadays, they were actually exported back to the Middle East. Because of the rotating blades and the roar of the engine, conversation was impossible. But whenever I happened to glance back at Micah, I noticed that he never stopped smiling. Once we returned from the helicopter ride, we had some free time until lunch, and we decided to go for a jog around the property. With thousands of miles logged on our legs over the course of our lifetimes, jogging felt natural to both of us. Falling into a moderate clip, our strides quickly became synchronized. "This is like old times," I said, "when we were back in high school." "I was just thinking the same thing." "How often do you jog these days?" "Not too much," Micah answered. His breaths were even and steady. "I run when I play soccer, but if I try to do it every day, my back gets sore." "I know what you mean. I used to run a fast 20 miles on Sundays, but these days I can't even imagine it. If I go 4 miles, I feel like I've really accomplished something.
That's because we're getting older, he said.
Do you realize my 20-year high school reunion is coming up in a few months?
Are you going?
I think so.
It'll be fun to see everyone.
But when I think of high school, I think about Mike, Harold, you, and Tracy. Now those were great times.
For a while, I listened to the sound of our feet on the compact dirt.
Do you remember when you and Harold went on a double date that one time? When Tracy and I found you and had you roll down the car window so we could launch a bottle rocket into your car?
I laughed. How could I forget?
The thing had exploded at our feet, scaring the daylights out of us.
Yeah, those are the memories that stay with me, he said.
Those guys were great, and they're the only ones I still really talk to anymore.
It's hard to believe that it all happened 20 years ago.
After lunch and a shower, we headed back to Ayers Rock with the rest of the group. By then, the glare was relentless. It was over 100 degrees, and with the sun high overhead, Ayers Rock was sandstone and unremarkable in color. Flies swarmed everywhere. You had to move continuously or they'd land on your lips or eyelashes, your arms and your back. There were trillions of flies. The tourists looked as if they'd taken wiggle pills. Over the next few hours, the bus stopped in various places around Ayers Rock, which is regarded as sacred among the Aborigines. We'd head out, walk around, listen to a story, then head back to the bus. We were led to some painted caves and a watering hole where we were exposed to endless lectures about Aboriginal history. At the third or fourth stop, I turned to say something to Micah. His eyes were glassy and unfocused. At that point, we'd been listening to a story concerning one of the upper crevices on the rock. It had to do with a spirit warrior who got lost in the desert, only to fight a battle with another spirit, and somehow the images of the battle had been imprinted on the rock. This, in turn, led people to know where the watering hole was. They would search the rock for said image, thereby knowing they were close. Or something like that. The blistering heat was making me dizzy, and it was difficult to keep all the characters in the legend straight.
Have you ever noticed that the less interesting something is, the longer people want to talk about it? Micah sighed, slapping at the buzzing flies.
Come on, it's interesting. It's a culture we know nothing about.
The reason we don't know anything about it is because it's boring.
It's not boring. It's a big rock in the middle of the desert.
What about the colors?
We saw the colors this morning. In the daytime, it's a big rock. And I wasn't being eaten by flies or cooked in the sun while being subjected to endless stories about spirit battles.
Doesn't it amaze you that people could actually survive out here for thousands of years?
It amazes me that they never left.
What, you mean no Aborigines ever wandered to the coast, saw the beaches and felt the cool breezes while catching fish for dinner and said to themselves, "Hey, maybe I should think about moving."
I think the heat's getting to you.
Oh yeah, it's getting to me. I'm dying out here. I feel like buzzards are overhead, just waiting for me to drop my guard.
Late in the day, we headed back to Ayers Rock for the third time. This would be our chance to see how it changed colors at sunset.
I'm beginning to get the impression that there's not much to do around here besides stare at Ayers Rock, Micah confided.
It won't be so bad, I said. I hear there's supposed to be original Aborigine music tonight.
Oh, gee, he said, throwing up his hands. I can't wait.
As it turned out, that evening was one of the trip's most memorable. It began with a cocktail party, and yes, everyone stared at Ayers Rock when the sun started going down. But afterward, we were led to a small clearing where tables had been set up, complete with white tablecloths, candle centerpieces, and beautiful floral arrangements. The setting was gorgeous and the food delicious. Among other things, on the buffet they had both kangaroo and crocodile meat, simmered in spices and cooked to perfection. The temperature cooled and even the flies seemed to have vanished. We ate in the desert under a slowly blackening sky. In time, the stars appeared in full. Later, the candles were blown out and an astronomer began to speak. Using a floodlight to point to various areas of the sky, she described the world above. Not only was it dark and clear enough to make out individual stars in the vast sweep of the Milky Way, but because we were in the southern hemisphere, the sky was completely foreign to us. We were all spellbound. Instead of the Big Dipper and Polaris, the North Star, we saw the Southern Cross and learned how sailors used it to navigate. Jupiter was closer to Earth than it had been in decades and glowed bright in the sky. Saturn, too, was visible, making it the first time I'd ever seen both planets in the same sky. Even better, we found out that TCS had made arrangements for telescopes. That evening, I saw the moons of Jupiter and the rings of Saturn, and while I'd seen them in books, I'd never seen them through a lens. It was a first for Micah, too. On the way back to the hotel, he leaned his head back on the seat, the picture of contentment. The morning was great, and the evening was the best on the trip so far. It's just the middle you could have done without, right? He smiled without opening his eyes. You're reading my mind, little brother. I leaned my head back and closed my eyes as well. No one on the bus was speaking. Most seemed as relaxed as we were. In the silence, my mind wandered. The years had passed so quickly that I couldn't help but feel as if my life seemed surreal, almost like I were viewing it through someone else's eyes. Perhaps it was because of the evening I'd just spent, or maybe it was due to exhaustion, but in the midst of this foreign land, I suddenly didn't feel like a 37-year-old author, or husband, or even a father of five. Instead, it almost seemed as if I were just starting out in the world and facing an uncertain future, similar to how I felt when I first stepped off the plane in South Bend, Indiana, in August 1984. My first year at Notre Dame proved to be a challenge. For the first time in my life, I wasn't the smartest kid in class, and my studies were much harder than I'd imagined they would be. I studied an average of 4 hours a day and didn't do nearly as well as I'd hoped. For the next 4 years, the number of hours I studied would only increase. I found it hard to be away from home. I missed my family and friends. I missed Lisa, and I didn't get along with my new roommate. Worst of all, the second week after I arrived, I strained my Achilles tendon, tried to train through the pain, and got a raging case of tendonitis. My Achilles swelled to the size of a golf ball. According to the doctors, the only thing that would allow it to heal was to stop running entirely. By that point, running was the most important thing in my life, and the idea of not running was counter to everything I believed in. My dream was to follow in Billy Mills's footsteps, to represent the United States on the Olympic team and win the gold medal. I know now that even had I never been injured, the dream was an unattainable one. I might as well have wished to fly. As I said, I was a good runner, but not a great one. I didn't have the natural foot speed or stamina to be world class. Indeed, I'd gotten as far as I had by training harder than most high schoolers. These realizations were only made in retrospect. At the time, the injury was devastating to me. For the first time in my life, I felt as if I were failing. The injury raged on throughout the fall. In the winter, it healed slightly before I re-injured it again. Around that time, Lisa and I broke up, high school sweethearts doomed by the distance between us. School continued to be a challenge, in part because my mind was elsewhere. I somehow managed to scrape together a partial outdoor season and even ended up breaking the school record as a member of one of the relay teams. It was my last meet of the year. By the time I finished the race, I could barely walk. My Achilles tendon had swollen to the size of a lemon. Any movement was excruciating. My tendon literally squeaked like a rusty hinge whenever I took a step. When I arrived back home for my summer break, I needed crutches to get off the plane. I was miserable for the first few weeks of the summer. I had no job, no girlfriend, and because my brother had moved out, no one to hang around with. In addition, I was under doctor's orders not to run for 3 months, which would only put me further behind my peers. My mom tried to come up with ways to cheer me up. At least that's what she called it. Paint the living room, she'd say. It'll cheer you up. Or sand the door so we can stain it a different color. It'll boost your spirits. Had her ideas worked, I would have been the most cheerful kid on the planet. As it was, however, I simply moped around in paint-splattered clothes, working all day on various projects and mumbling that all I wanted to do was run, and wondering why God wouldn't help or listen to me. By mid-June, my mother had grown exasperated with my attitude, and as I was lamenting my plight for the 100th time at the kitchen table, finally shook her head. "Your problem is that you're bored. You need to find something to do." "I don't want to do anything but run." "What if you can't?" "What do you mean?" "What if your injury never gets better? Or, even if it does, what if you can't train the way you want to anymore for fear of hurting it again? You don't want to spend your life doing nothing." "Mom." "Hey, I'm just offering up the obvious here. I know it wouldn't be fair, but no one ever said that life was fair." I lowered my head to the table. "Oh, no," she said firmly. "You're not going to just sit here at the table and keep acting this way. Don't just pout. Do something about it." "Like what?" "It's your life." I raised my head in frustration.
Mom?
I don't know, she said with a shrug. Then she looked at me and said the words that would eventually change my life. Write a book. Until that moment, I'd never considered writing. Granted, I read all the time, but actually sitting down and coming up with a story on my own? The very notion was ridiculous. I knew nothing about the craft. I had no burning desire to see my words in print. I'd never taken a class in creative writing, had never written for the yearbook or school newspaper, nor did I suspect I had some sort of hidden talent when it came to composing prose. Yet, despite all those things, the notion was somehow appealing, and I found myself answering, okay. The next morning I sat down at my dad's typewriter, rolled in the first sheet of paper, and began to write. I chose horror as a genre, and conjured up a character who caused accidental death wherever he went. 6 weeks and nearly 300 pages later, after writing 6 or 7 hours a day, I'd finished. To this day, I can remember typing the final sentence, and I don't know that I'd ever felt a higher sense of accomplishment with anything I'd done in my life. The only problem was the book. It was terrible, and I knew it. It was atrocious in every sense of the word, but in the end, what did it matter? I didn't intend for it to be published. I'd written it to see if I could. Even then, I knew there was a big difference between starting a novel and actually finishing one. Even more surprising, I found that I'd actually enjoyed the process. I was 19 years old and had become an accidental author. It's funny the way things happen in life. Because I was away from home 8 months a year, my brother and I had little time to see each other. Micah continued to spend weekends trying new and exciting things. Meanwhile, my injury continued to plague me. I ran neither cross-country nor track, but concentrated on making a comeback. I made good friends with a few other freshmen the year before, some of whom were on the track team, and they became the ones I would depend on to get me through yet another challenging year. But I learned something by heading off to college. My dependence on family had diminished more than it had for either my brother or sister. Dana still lived at home and was a freshman in college. Though Micah was living in his own apartment, he still made it home 3 or 4 times a week. Whenever I called home, it always seemed as if he was there. Soon after I'd left for my sophomore year, my mom mentioned that Brandy wasn't doing well. She was 12 years old, not old for some breeds, but ancient for a Doberman, and I could hear the concern in my mom's voice. My mom loved her, as we all did, and when I pressed my mom, her answers were slightly evasive. Well, she's lost a little weight, and her arthritis seems to be getting worse. When I came home for fall break, I was shocked by Brandy's appearance. I hadn't seen her in 2 months, but in those 2 months she'd gone from being relatively healthy to a walking skeleton. Her stomach caved in, and it was possible to count her ribs from across the room. As she slowly wandered toward me, I could see the happy recognition in her eyes. Her tail, bone-thin and nearly hairless, waved a slow greeting. I crouched down and stroked her softly, feeling her shake and tremble beneath my hand. I swallowed the lump in my throat. I spent most of the next 2 days with the dog, sitting beside her and patting her gently. I knew even then that she wouldn't last until Christmas. I murmured quietly to her, reminding her of all the adventures we'd had together growing up. The day before I was to head back to Notre Dame, we woke to find that Brandy had died. My brother and I held back our tears as we went to get our sister. Dana made no pretense of being tough and began to sob immediately. It was the sound of her wailing that made my brother and me both begin to cry as well, and later that morning, with tears stinging our eyes, we dug a hole in the backyard and buried her. She was gone now, except for memories that we would hold forever. She waited until you were home, Micah said earnestly. I think she must have known you were coming back and wanted to see you one last time. Years later, we discovered the truth of what happened to Brandy. Brandy, we learned, hadn't really died in her sleep. She died at the veterinarian's office earlier that morning, with my mother holding her tight as the final injection was administered. Afterward, while we were still sleeping, my mom had brought Brandy back home and placed her in the bed for us to find. She didn't want us to know that Brandy had been put down. She wanted the three of us to believe that Brandy had died peacefully in her sleep. My mom knew we would have been devastated by the idea of putting her to sleep, and thought it was important to spare our feelings. Even though we were grown, even though she'd always stressed toughness, she didn't want Brandy's death to be harder on us than it had to be. I had surgery on both my Achilles and my foot in April of my sophomore year.
Both my Achilles and plantar fascia, a tendon that runs along the bottom of the foot, had been severely damaged by intensive training. It was touch and go as to whether I would ever run again. With the dream still burning, I went through rehab and began jogging in July. By mid-August, I was running without pain for the first time in years. I trained hard and was soon recording the fastest training times I'd ever run in the past. In the second hard workout of the day, for instance, I clipped through 5 miles in a little more than 23 minutes and was never out of breath. By October, though, the pain was back and getting worse, and I had a cortisone injection at the site of the old injury. An anti-inflammatory, it numbs the area, and I kept on running. When the pain came back 6 weeks later, I got another cortisone shot. Soon I was getting them monthly, but I salvaged a respectable season nonetheless. By summer, I needed to receive cortisone injections weekly to continue training. I'd had nearly 30 injections since the surgery, and I had to gear myself up for one last season. Both my Achilles and plantar fascia were swollen. As I limped out to the track for a workout, I remember realizing with a sense of clear-eyed finality that I simply couldn't do it anymore. I hung up my shoes for good, feeling sadness and, strangely, relief. With the exception of breaking a school record that still stands after 19 years, I'd failed to reach the other goals I'd set for myself. But despite the fact that running had been the defining force in my life for the previous 7 years, I knew that I'd survive without it. I'd given it my best shot, but it wasn't meant to be. And if I had to do it all over, and failed to reach my dream again, I would. When you chase a dream, you learn about yourself. You learn your capabilities and limitations and the value of hard work and persistence. When I told my dad about my decision, sharing my disappointment as well as relief in knowing that I'd finally made a decision, he put his arm around my shoulder. "Everyone has dreams," he said, "and even if yours didn't work out the way you wanted, it doesn't make me any less proud of you. Too many people never really try." That year, my mom finally got the horse she'd always wanted. A 3-year-old Arabian, she named it Chinook. Chinook was boarded at a stable near the American River, and my mom would drop in to feed and groom the horse before and after work. She could spend hours brushing Chinook's coat, cleaning her stable, and cleaning the mud from her hooves. Although there were riding trails along the American River, it was months before my mom could ride her. Chinook had lived most of her life in a pasture, along with a goat, and had never had so much as a saddle placed on her back, which was a big part of the reason my mom could afford to buy her. She was high-strung like many Arabians, but my mom had a natural talent when it came to calming her. Soon, Chinook allowed my mom to saddle her. When she got used to that, my mom finally crawled on. Chinook didn't seem to like it, but my mom was patient, and I remember the joy in my mom's voice one day when she called me on the phone. "I rode Chinook for hours today," she said. "You can't believe how wonderful it was." "I'm happy for you, Mom," I said. My mom had lived a life of sacrifice, her own dreams always coming second to ours. I couldn't help but feel it was finally time that she got something that made her happy. Later, she would get a second horse named Napoleon. Napoleon was good-natured and even-tempered, the kind of horse that was perfect for my father. And surprising me, my father agreed to go riding as well. Though my dad was never comfortable in the saddle, I think it was his way of showing my mom that he was willing to work on the marriage. Years of emotional distance had strained their relationship, and Micah sometimes mentioned that he thought my mom had nearly reached the breaking point. Where once she was willing to stay married for the sake of the children, she now sometimes wondered aloud whether she would be happier without my dad. I don't know if either my mom or my dad ever seriously considered divorce. I do know, however, that my mom spoke the word with increasing frequency, both on the phone and around the house. And my dad, no doubt, had heard her speak of it as well. Rapprochement is always difficult. When distance has grown over the years, it's sometimes impossible to overcome. Yet horseback riding together offered my parents a way to do just that, and little by little my parents seemed to enjoy a budding sense of renewal between them. My brother continued to live his carefree existence. After graduation from college in 1987, he and a friend went to Europe and bicycled around Spain, France, and Italy for nearly a month. Upon his return, he shared stories about the adventure before taking a trip to the mountains to go whitewater rafting. In August, he began working full-time as a commercial real estate broker. He continued to date energetically. He brought a different girl home every couple of weeks to meet our parents, and every date seemed crazy about him.
In time, my mom called me with the news that he'd brought a particular girl over twice. For Micah, that was just about the closest thing to a steady girlfriend he'd had in years. And when he brought her by a third time, I think my mom knew it was serious. At Notre Dame, I was edging toward a degree in business finance, with the hope of attending law school after graduation. In March of 1988, a few friends and I decided to drive down to Florida for our final spring break. Because one of my roommate's fathers owned a condominium on Sanibel Island, we opted to go there instead of the usual destinations like Daytona or Fort Lauderdale. On our second night there, I noticed a woman walking with a couple of girlfriends through the parking lot of the condominium. She was attractive, but so was practically everyone after an evening on the town, and she quickly passed from my mind. A moment later, however, when my friends and I had almost reached the lobby, we heard voices calling down to us from the external hallway on the sixth floor. "Hey, are you guys staying here?" When we looked up, we noticed the same three girls. "Yes," we answered. "Well, we're supposed to meet a couple of friends, but they're not here yet, and we really have to go to the bathroom. Can we use yours?" "Sure," we shouted. "We're on the eighth floor." They came up and introduced themselves as seniors from the University of New Hampshire, and we let them in our room to use the bathroom. A moment later, the three of them stood in the kitchen, but my eyes were glued to the woman I had noticed earlier. Up close, she had the most beautiful eyes I'd ever seen. So unusual in color, they almost looked unreal. It was all I could do not to stare. "Hi," I finally said. "I'm Nick." She smiled. "Hi, Nick. I'm Kathy." I would love to tell you that the initial attraction was mutual, but I'd be lying if I did. The girls stayed in our room for half an hour or so and invited us down to their friend's place. While we were there, I got their phone number from one of Kathy's friends and promised to call the next day to see if they wanted to hang out at the beach behind the condominium. When they decided to join us the following morning, I was palpably nervous about seeing Kathy again. I hoped I'd made a good impression on her, and when I saw her and her friends coming toward us on the beach, I quickly rose to greet them. "Hey," I said eagerly, "I'm glad you could come." To which Kathy replied, "Oh, hey, I'm Kathy. I didn't meet you last night, did I?" Despite the ego bruising, I wasn't about to be deterred. We ended up talking for hours. When they mentioned that they were going out to a nearby nightclub, I talked my reluctant roommates into going and immediately sought out Kathy. After dancing with her for an hour, I leaned in and said, "You know, you and I are going to get married one day." She just laughed in disbelief and said, "I think you need another beer." How could I tell so quickly that she was the one for me? It was an odd intuitive moment, but I can honestly say that I knew. We had a lot in common. Like me, she was a senior who was earning a degree in business. Like me, she was Catholic and went to church every Sunday. She was also a middle child, though one of four. Like me, she had an older brother and a younger sister. Her parents, like mine, were poor before attaining middle-class status, had never been divorced, and, how's this for coincidence, shared the same anniversary as my parents, August 31st. She was an athlete, a state champion in gymnastics. She wanted children, as did I, and she wanted to stay home to raise them, as I hoped my wife would. But most of all, what really attracted me to her was her manner. She laughed a lot, and it's easy to fall for someone who can find humor in any situation. She was also intelligent, well-read, and well-spoken, willing to listen and confident in her beliefs. And most of all, she was warm. She treated my friends as if they'd been her friends for years, would wave and smile at both children and the elderly. She seemed genuinely interested in everyone. I had noticed all of these things about her, and as we were dancing, it struck me that she was everything I wanted in a lifelong companion. When I got back to Notre Dame, I called my brother. "Micah," I said, "I met the girl I'm going to marry." "Where? When? Weren't you just on spring break?" "Yeah, that's where I met her." "Dude," he said, "you were on spring break. What the hell are you thinking about marriage for?" "Just wait until you meet her." "But it was spring break." "I know," I said gleefully. "Isn't it great?" In the 2 months leading up to graduation, I wrote Kathy 100 letters. She came out to visit me at Notre Dame twice, and on the day of my graduation, my parents came to visit Notre Dame for the first time. While I showed them around the place that had been my home for the previous 4 years, I talked mainly about Kathy and how much she'd come to mean to me in the previous 2 months. After graduation, while my parents flew back home, I traveled to New Hampshire to see Kat graduate. I was introduced to her parents, and 10 days later I brought her to Sacramento to meet my parents. My mom and dad greeted her with immediate hugs, and Kathy remained in the kitchen talking to my mom for an hour. That night, after Kathy had gone to bed, my mom declared, "Kathy's wonderful. She's even better than you described." I thought my heart would burst. "I'm glad you like her, Mom," was all I said. After graduation in May 1988, my first thought was, what now? For years, I'd been a student and an athlete and had pursued those goals with an unwavering intensity. I had done as I was told. I had followed the rules. Yet all of a sudden, both worlds were behind me, and I found myself adrift. I had no idea who I was, what I wanted to do, or where my future would lead. I'd always believed that because I'd followed the rules, the world would beat a path to my doorstep. But the world didn't seem to care at all. Despite graduating with high honors, I wasn't accepted to any of the law schools to which I'd applied, and so that door was closed even before it opened. All my friends had taken corporate jobs in New York or Chicago, but those jobs also tended to be close to the places they'd grown up. I, too, wanted to go home, and with my head filled with foggy notions of the future, I found myself on a plane back to Sacramento. My first job was waiting tables. Even with a degree, I found myself earning minimum wage. In the meantime, I began exploring careers, trying to find an area that interested me. Though I was confused, I wasn't particularly worried, and by the time Kathy moved to Sacramento in August, I finally made the decision to try my hand at appraising real estate. Around the same time, Micah and I purchased 2 small rental houses in a rundown area of town, repaired them, and were renting them out as well. In the little spare time remaining, I wrote a second novel, titled The Royal Murders, an old-fashioned whodunit. I knew, however, it wasn't good enough to be published. I began working for a local firm as an appraiser's apprentice by day, while continuing to wait tables and write at night, and eventually saved enough money to buy a small diamond ring. On her birthday, October 12, 1988, I proposed to Kathy on bended knee, and she said yes. A few days later, I asked Micah to be my best man, thinking that not only had he been by my side throughout our youth, but that he would continue to be by my side no matter where the future took us. Chapter 12. Angkor, Cambodia. February 4th to 5th. The temples at Angkor, Cambodia, an area encompassing nearly 120 square miles, were built from AD 879 to 1191, when the Khmer Empire was at its zenith. More than 100 temples have been discovered, and they were once surrounded by cities from which the kings of the empire ruled over a domain that covered a vast portion of Southeast Asia, including Burma, Thailand, Laos, Vietnam, southern China, and Cambodia. Their rule lasted nearly 500 years, until 1432 when the Siamese, Thai, sacked Angkor and the capital was moved south to Phnom Penh. Angkor never regained its former stature, and eventually drifted into obscurity as the jungle continued its never-ending encroachment. In time, Angkor passed into legend. People who saw the ruins claimed they'd been built by the gods, and a few adventurous explorers from Europe circulated stories about the famous ruins among their peers. It wasn't until 1860 that the French explorer Henri Mouhot brought Angkor back to the world's attention. The French were enchanted by the ruins and began an extensive restoration effort. Yet all that remained of Angkor were the temples themselves, which are regarded as one of mankind's greatest architectural achievements. The cities, whose buildings were constructed of wood, had long since decayed and vanished into the surrounding jungle. The vast majority of the temples in the Angkor region are Hindu in influence. The remainder are Buddhist. At the time of their construction, both belief systems were prevalent in the empire, and as rulers came and went, Buddhists replaced by Hindus and vice versa, temples were constructed to reflect the changing times. Still, the architecture varied only slightly. Most contained a temple mountain-like structure in the center, surrounded by square or circular walls or platforms, and enclosed within either a moat or perimeter wall. Angkor Wat, literally city temple, is not only the largest temple in the Angkor complex, but the largest religious monument in existence. Constructed during the first half of the 12th century by Suryavaram II, it's regarded as the high point of Khmer architecture.
Once inside, the carvings on the outer walls depict important scenes from Hindu literature, as well as events from the reign of Suryavaram II, in exacting, intricate detail. To study and fully understand the relief carvings on walls 12 feet high and spanning over a kilometer in length would take years. Entire books have been written on the subject of the carvings alone, and it's far beyond the scope of this volume.